Does the music you listen to when you are young corrupt you, have a deleterious effect of some sort on your development in adult life? For instance, does having metal in your head harm you? Will I be doing you damage with 45 seconds of Motorhead? Well, I might, and I don't want to frighten the horses, so let's start with the music everyone who learns the guitar has a go at, even now, I think, at some stage. Deep Purple, writing about an eventful visit to Switzerland when the Montreux Casino burnt down. Coming up, Professor Tasha Howe on the effect of devotion to heavy metal. And her study looked at the 1980s heavy metal scene. And in it, groupies, musicians and fans recalled their experiences. And there is analysis, more to the point, of what that wild youth did to them. And no one died in that casino fire, perhaps more through good luck than good management. Dr. Tasha Howe is a developmental psychopathologist. She is professor and chair of the psychology department at Humboldt State University in California. And Tasha is a two-time Fulbright scholar as well, and her work mainly focuses on child abuse prevention. As well, she's a former heavy metal groupie. Hello, Tasha.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Heavy metal seems not to have done you lasting harm.
Quite the contrary. I think looking back, I think it in some ways saved my life.
Yes, I want to talk about that exactly. What sort of heavy metaler were you, if you can describe your youth?
Well, actually, when I was in middle school, 12, 13, I was into punk. So I shaved my head and I was listening to the Dead Kennedys and Fear and all those bands. And then one day I heard on KROQ, which was a famous Los Angeles radio station, the song Livewire by Motley Crue. And I was just, who is that? Who is that? And so they happened to be playing in Los Angeles quite soon after that. So I got tickets, and my best friend and I went, and we happened to get backstage and meet the band, and that was it. I was turned. Heavy metal was it from that point forward.
I can understand the excitement of that moment. There was research back in the 1980s, though, suggesting that metalheads were at risk for poor developmental outcomes. You'll probably know about that.
Oh, yeah. The previous research, there actually wasn't a ton of research, but the few studies that had been done showed that people who listened to heavy metal were more depressed, they were more badly adjusted in terms of school and family relationships. They did work on kids like in psychiatric hospitals and things like that who happened to listen to heavy metal. So most of the research pointed to a pretty grim picture.
How do you define, just before we get to your study, how do you define a metalhead? I played Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water before you came on, and it makes the all-time best lists, but I imagine it's more correctly defined as rock. So what is metal?
Well, people do argue that Smoke on the Water is one of the oldest heavy metal songs, and people place the origins of heavy metal with Led Zeppelin and different bands, you know, so there's different ideas about Blue Cheer starting it, so it's controversial, but basically heavy metal is pretty loud pounding guitars, some screaming vocals or growling vocals, pretty intense emotion, whether it's like sexual tension or aggression. And there's many different genres of metal, all the way from death metal, industrial metal. So the kind of metal that I was listening to since I was growing up in L.A. was the L.A. metal scene. We were listening to Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue, and then Metallica was up in the Bay Area, and so we were listening to Anthrax and bands like that. And then on the tail end of that came more of a glam metal movement with Poison and Warrant and those things. So it's kind of hard to pin it down into one type of music, but there's a lot of different types of metal.
What did you look like out of interest back then?
Well, I was, let's say, scantily clad, like most girls who were in Hollywood. We would wear fishnet stockings, stiletto heels, a lot of leather, lingerie as shirts. Big hair. There was a type of hairspray called Aquanet, and all of us had the biggest hair you could possibly get with the pink can of Aquanet and tons of makeup.
I wish I'd discovered Aquanet. Now, how did you proceed with your own very interesting study, Tasha?
Well, it was interesting because I was writing a memoir about my life when I was on sabbatical from the university. And so I was writing the memoir, reliving all the metal days and all the bands I knew and all that sort of thing. And I was talking to my PhD advisor about that, and he said, haven't you ever wondered what happened to all the people like you? Because no one would have predicted that you would get a PhD and be a college professor and now a Fulbright scholar. And I was thinking, yeah, I have wondered about those people. And this is kind of right when Facebook was getting started. And so several people from that era had friended me on Facebook, but I was kind of skeptical about social media. I thought it was like the CIA or something. So I wasn't really forthcoming and getting to know people. But then I started talking to Howard Friedman, who ended up being my co-author, and he was just saying, you know, we should do a study. And I started thinking how fun that would be for my students and my research lab to do a study on heavy metal people. So we just designed this huge study, and it ended up being really fun for my students. We published two papers out of it, and it ended up winning an award for best paper of the year from a Psychological Society for Self and Identity. So it just ended up being really fun and interesting.
Fantastic. It wasn't just people you knew locally and so on. You actually came down under for some of your sample group, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, the surveys were anonymous, so I don't even know who answered them, but we did this thing called snowball sampling, where I just went on to all these metal groups on social media and put the post up, hey, if you're between the ages of 35 and 60 and you want to answer questions about your adolescence in the 80s, you know, fill out this survey. It's anonymous, and you can be honest and tell your story. And so it was like, and tell your friends, copy the link and tell your friends. And so it ended up going all over the world. We asked people what metal scenes they were part of, and a lot of them were from Australia, England, New York, you know, different metal groups.
Tasha, your study showed metalheads were significantly happier in their youth and better adjusted currently than either middle-aged or current college-age youth comparison groups. Now, how and in what ways?
Well, what we did was we tried to figure out all of the questions that the research in the 80s left unanswered. So we wanted to know, first of all, are people who are attracted to metal just different? Do they have a different personality style or type than other people? So we assess 10 different types of personality traits, from neuroticism to conscientiousness, extroversion, all these different personality traits. We assess childhood trauma, thinking maybe their childhoods were different. We assess their attachment styles, meaning how secure they are in romantic relationships and friendships. We had an 85-page questionnaire. We tried to figure out every single thing we could, and the only thing that differed was the type of music they liked. So we tried to control for any other explanations. And that's why we included the college students, because we wanted to be sure their answers were not just reflective of, like, young people in general. So we got young people today to see if they differed from them, as well as people 35 to 60 who liked other types of music. So I was predicting that there was going to be no difference, that we were going to contradict the research and they were all going to be the same and all middle-aged people are similar. Mm. So it was shocking to find out that the metal people were actually much more well-adjusted and happier in terms of depression, psychological counseling. Looking back at their youth, they had no regrets. In fact, the metal group, we asked a lot of open-ended questions like, what do you think people should understand about youth of the 80s or of heavy metal fans? And all the other groups were just talking about how we're misunderstood, people stereotype us. But the metal people were the only group that said, we don't care what people think about us. So it was just a really interesting group. They were talking about how they had all kinds of childhood trauma. They experienced child abuse, alcoholism. They had used more drugs, had more sexual partners. They had more STDs than the other groups, but they were happier. They had no regrets. They didn't miss more days of work from psychological problems or physical illnesses. They had similar incomes. So we were just surprised at how much happier and healthier the metal groups was than the people who liked other types of music.
And metalheads also did not seek counselling for emotional problems as much as the people in the comparison group. What does this tell you?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously seeking counselling can be good for you, but when you couple that with the idea of, we had them rate how happy they are in life in general on a 0 to 100 scale, and then to look back to their youth to see how happy they were. And metalheads were up in like the 85 to 90 happy in their youth and the same happy now. And they also reported not seeking counseling throughout their lives. So it's not that counseling in itself is a bad thing, but it's just an indication that the people who didn't like metal had less happiness and were seeking counseling more. So they were having more struggles in life.
Have I got this right? What your study seems to suggest is that you find a companion group as a teen, maybe one with a firm identity that enables you to rebel a bit, and that camaraderie serves you very well. It could it be anything with sufficient edge that you feel a part of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably true of many other style cultures than just metal. In fact, I was just interviewed by a woman who's making a documentary about hip-hop groupies, and she feels the same way about hip-hop, people who are super into, like, gangster rap. You know, it provides you with style tips, language, slang, like-minded people. It's kind of like giving the finger to middle-class society. And especially in metal, there was a lot of criticism in the lyrics of hypocrisy. And when you're young, especially if you do come from a traumatic childhood like so many of the metalheads did, this was their family. It's like your tribe that you form, and you can really just feel empowered by being around those people and developing a strong identity where it's okay if your family's messed up. It's okay if you're living in a society where you can't make a living because you have this group to support you.
I feel great regret now that I conformed so much. There was always a bit of an inner metaller in me longing to get out. Anyway.
Maybe you had a very stable family and you didn't need an alternative style culture.
Oh, thank you, Tasha. Your husband actually was a heavy metal singer with the band Metal Church, wasn't he?
Still is, in fact. We're no longer together, unfortunately, but we're still friends. And he did a reunion album a few years ago, and it's hugely successful. So I'm really proud of him. He's out touring around the world, playing festivals, and yeah, they're doing great. So Metal Church is rising from, you know, the retirement age.
Retirement villages tour. Just getting back to what they endured, you knew people who died of AIDS, and there would have been drugs and car accidents. And, any, you know, if you're living that rock and roll lifestyle, things happen. Do things happen to all groups, though? I'm just wondering, you couldn't take into account those metalheads who didn't make it through, of course, because they're no longer with us. But I suppose that applies to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with self-report research, is you're only getting the people who are volunteering to talk to you. And so some people who may have been really dysfunctional may not have answered the questions. But that's why we wanted the comparison group of people who also grew up in the 80s but just liked other music. And just like, you know, the 80s, AIDS affected everyone. A lot of people died of drug overdoses. I certainly knew people who died in car accidents, and AIDS and all of those things were affecting people. But yeah, it would affect all the different groups of people. So the dysfunctional people who liked, say, Madonna and Michael Jackson, they would also not choose to answer the survey, or they might be dead or in jail or whatever also. So it was the best thing we could do to even out the groups, to try to control for some of those other explanations.
You know, metal might seem like fun now, but there was hostility towards it then. And having had a religious upbringing to an extent, like a lot of people, I would never listen to those songs about Satan being at the Sabbath and so on. And there were an awful lot of those songs. It was right out there, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for most of us, it was just fun, ha-ha, like tongue-in-cheek. I don't think any of us who were listening to Ozzy Osbourne or Black Sabbath, or, you know, I was even listening to Venom and some darker bands, but I don't think any of us were actually, like, worshiping the devil. In fact, what I found most commonly among the people I knew is they were more likely to be agnostic or atheist, that they just didn't believe in Christian ideology. So if you don't believe in Christian ideology, you don't believe in the devil either. It just doesn't exist. And so most of the people were doing it tongue-in-cheek. They liked the visuals. You know, Motley Crue had the pentagram, and they'd light their boots on fire and have candelabras and things like that. But I don't think anyone was really worshiping the devil.
Okay, so you didn't know anyone who bit the heads off bats?
Well, I guess Ozzy actually bit the head off of a dove or a bat in one of his record company interviews, but as he's talked about that later, that was more a fact of him being completely blitzed out of his mind on drugs than any sort of devil worship.
The thing is, you know, you talk about other genres, and I suppose hip-hop would be the modern equivalent, but if you grew up listening to, immersed in country music or classical, then you wouldn't have got that same sense of belonging and ability to rebel. That's the difference, isn't it?
I think it could be, but I mean, there are plenty of classical artists that were seen as really, you know, rebels and fringe at the time, and they were just doing things that were totally unorthodox. You know, Vivaldi was known to be a partier, so I don't think it's out of the question to see that there are rebels and people who take things in a more risque direction in all genres. But at the same time, keep in mind that this is a business. All of music is a business. So whether it's hip-hop, you know, taunting people with their diamonds and their fancy cars and all this stuff, they're trying to create an image that people gravitate towards so they'll buy things and they'll support your music. And so a lot of the images in heavy metal, too, were a business, whether it was glam metal being super sexy and sort of transgender-ish, or whether it was the more satanic metal with the pentagrams and things. Kids were intrigued by that, and they were going to buy your records. So the bottom line is there's a little capitalist thread going through all of music.
Nevertheless, that's a good point. Nevertheless, less counseling required, fewer regrets looking back, happier generally. These are such interesting findings.
What? And couple that with the fact that they had extreme childhood trauma, took a lot of drugs, had a lot of sex, and had all kinds of crazy stuff going on in the 80s. It was really surprising.
Yeah, no, it is surprising. A lot of people will find it surprising. So what is the takeaway from it in terms of looking at the youth cohort today, and maybe as a parent giving advice, or at least as a parent knowing what to tolerate and what not to, etc.? What is the takeaway from your research in terms of how young people should actually behave in those early years?
Well, I think I do have a 16-year-old son and a 21-year-old son, and the tact that I've taken is to not ban any music, but to talk to them about it. For example, my 16-year-old loves gangster rap. There's a lot of N-words, there's a lot of misogyny, there's a lot of calling women the B-word and so forth, and so I just talk to him about it. Why do you like this music? You know they're just trying to make money. And I hope you would never disrespect women like this. And so I've raised him to be a feminist and respect women. And yes, he listens to this music, but I haven't seen him act any of those things out in his daily life in terms of, like, disrespecting women or things like that. In fact, I've heard him call his teenage friends on sexist remarks that they have made. So I think parents, and this is supported by developmental psychology research, need to know what their kids are watching. What are your kids playing? What are the games? So I sit here when my son's playing video games and I talk to him about the games. What are the goals? Why do you think this is fun? Why is this better than other games? So the more you know and can communicate and are involved with your kids, you don't really need to ban things unless it's just completely age inappropriate. I mean, I wouldn't want a 5-year-old, playing Mafia on the PlayStation or something like that. But you really just need to keep the lines of communication open and be able to express your views to your kids about why you don't like what they're playing.
Okay. But there would also seem to be a key strategy indicated for being in an inclusive, bolstering fraternity or sorority. You know, that there seems to be a sense of belonging here that's important.
Oh, yeah. I think for the teenagers, they really like to have their own little culture that's away from the establishment and away from the watchful eye of the adults, especially if you don't have a supportive family. You know, most of the kids I knew back there in Hollywood, we did not have parents that were cooking dinner for us and helping us with our homework. So if you don't have a supportive family, these style cultures can really be an alternative family for you. And those who have great supportive families, they're often not going to be going off the deep end.
So when the Who sang "The Kids Are All Right," they were correct, actually.
I think so, yeah.
Hey, lovely to hear about your research. Thank you, Professor Natasha Howe. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for your interest.